Welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. This is Renee. I'm drinking a Black Butte Porter by Deschutes Brewery. We are here with Cameron Pierce, author of, I don't even know which one's list because they're all great and they all have amazing titles. Abortion Arcade, Gargoyle Girls of Spiderland, which is hard to say, Ask Goblins of Auschwitz, among many other things. Also, the editor at Lazy Fascist Press. Cameron, how are you doing, and what are you drinking tonight?
Hey, I'm doing just fine, and I am drinking the Dayman Coffee IPA, which is a collaboration between Stone, Aleman, and Two Brothers Coffee House. It's probably the first coffee IPA I've ever had, and quite good. So I got to give a shout-out to Ross Lockhart for that recommendation.
Yeah, I got to say, I love coffee, and I love IPA, so I'm a little jealous because I've not seen that on the shelves down here.
I stopped by Caps and Corks, my favorite beer shop here in Portland today, and they had just gotten it on the shelves. It was still warm in the fridge there. So, yeah, definitely look for it and pick it up when you find it.
I'll have to ask around. There's a little shop down the street from me that's not really a liquor store. It's like a convenience grocery because I kind of live in the middle of nowhere. But the son of the guy who owns is really into craft beer and beer in general, so there's always a fun selection there. I might have to drop a recommendation for him to get that one in. Jessica, what are you going to wow us with tonight?
Oh, I'm drinking Blue Moon. I don't care. It's good. Next,
Dakota.
just more cheap beer. Nothing special. I'm kind of slacking here lately.
What cheap beer
I usually don't
you...
drink. Yeah. I don't usually drink at home that much anymore. Because
really?
You go out.
Just with us.
See what kind of trouble I can get in. You know?
Oh. See, I'm the opposite now. I only drink at home.
It's so boring.
I just drink in general.
I'm super boring, but I like to stay where I'm comfy.
Yes, with Blue Moon in her home.
Yes.
So... diving right in. I wanted to talk a little bit about Abortion Arcade because specifically The Destroyed Room. I have to admit, I haven't read it yet, and this is why. Today I was doing some research and I noticed that The Destroyed Room popped up in the Bizarro Starter Kit and the Abortion Arcade. And the reviews of that story were so amazing. And then I saw that it was available on Kindle, and I went to get it, and it's not. And you have to get the book, right? So, but...
Oh, yeah, Abortion Arcade should be on the Kindle. Yeah, yeah.
Abortion Arcade is, but I was reading that it was like that the Destroyed Room specifically was going to be available as a Kindle single or something. And that didn't happen. So... But I wanted to talk about it because I thought, like, what I was reading, and of course everyone's very careful not to give spoilers, but the premise of the story was so freaking cool that instead of doing my normal prep for the show, I spent all of this time trying to find it when, if I was smart, I would have just bought Abortion Arcade and skipped to the story I wanted to read, and that'll probably happen tomorrow. What I wanted to ask about, so the premise of the story... from what I can tell, and you can correct me if I kind of got the wrong impression, but it's a very surreal setting with a lot of strange things going on, but the protagonist realizes that all of the living things in this very artificial world he lives in are attached to by strings that only he can see. And you can tell me if what I'm about to say is a spoiler, and I'll cut it. He cuts the strings on his wife, and she dies.
Yeah. Yep, she dies.
So I was wondering if you went into that story specifically, like, paying homage to the old, like, Greek mythology about the cutting of the strings and all of that, or if it was just something that kind of came up because of more of an allegory with, like, puppetry and marionettes and things, or if it was a little bit of both.
I guess it was a little bit of both. You know, when I started that story, I was about to get into a new novella, and talking with Carlton Alec III, who's been my mentor for years, he reminded me of this idea I had pitched him years back before I started what became my first book, Shark Hunting in Paradise Garden. And it was just this world where, you know, everyone has these strings, like marionettes, and somebody who realizes that. So it came from there. And at the time, I was reading a lot of minimalist writers, and I wanted to do a quieter, bizarre story set in an alternate, not really future world Portland, but, you know, just a weird world Portland, without mentioning the city by name, and the destroyed room is what happened.
And the other thing in discussing that story and in the story that Jessica and I read in preparation and a couple other things that I've read of yours, the theme that kind of kept coming up, the other story was, shit, Jessica, what was it called? Our Love Will Go the Way of the Salmon?
Oh,
yeah,
Our Love
yeah.
Will Go the Way of the Salmon, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. is it, while you do take a very bizarre and absurdist approach to your storytelling, there always is like an emotional undercurrent to these stories that really brings the reader in. And you know, for instance, when reading Our Love Will Go the Way of the Salmon, it felt like the absurdist elements were so necessary to that emotional feeling that I can't imagine that story without the elements that you included. And normally when I read Bizarro, I think of it more of a total escapist thing where you're just in this weird place with lots of weird stuff going on and you're in it for the joyride. Whereas I didn't get that sense from the things of yours that I read.
I suppose that's sort of a shift that's occurring within Bizarro and has been for a couple of years now with writers like Jeremy Robert Johnson, J. David Osborne, Chris Armstrong, and a lot more who are, I guess, demanding a little bit more from the weird
mm-hmm.
elements and asking them to service not just the story but the emotional heart of the story. And that's always occurred within Bizarro. There's always been that element. I'm just seeing a lot more of that, and I'm seeing readers turning more and more toward that side of things.
We had Jeremy on the show well, a while ago now, but yeah, you're absolutely right. He's also really talented at that. I guess this sort of ties into some of the listener questions. So one of the questions, I guess, and this is sort of already what we talked about, but maybe you could expand on it a little bit. Sean Leonard, who basically wrote our interview tonight because he had so many great questions. So hi, Sean. He says, I'd like to hear about his thoughts on the bizarre genre, how its evolution compares to your initial expectations when it was first picking up steam and labeled a genre, and what you like and dislike about the current state of bizarro fiction.
Well, you know, I got into Bizarro when I was still in high school. I think that was around like 2005. And at that point, it was basically my primary goal in life to be published by Eraserhead Press before I turned 30. And, you know, a couple of years later, I ended up being lucky enough to receive a 5-book contract with Eraserhead and saw my first book published before I turned 21. So I've been a part of the Bizarro scene for more years than I can count at this point, but definitely wasn't one of the first people. Came in, I guess, during the second wave. But I think Bizarro has already surpassed most expectations that anyone had for it, that quite frequently small uprisings or movements in literature pop up, and they usually disintegrate within a couple of years, either because people move on to other creative pursuits or they just can't get along. I think Bizarro has stuck around and has only grown and become stronger since starting off as a little, you know, group of writers who had sometimes misguided ideas about how the publishing world should work, but it's matured and developed because everyone within the community can and does get along. And the forces behind Bizarro, like Rose O'Keefe, who runs Eraserhead Press, ensure that a lot of community building occurs through BizarroCon, definitely, you know, maintaining a strong presence on the internet, and encouraging local Bizarro hours and other events to happen throughout the country for those who can't make it out to BizarroCon, and just so that, you know, regularly people are seeing each other in person and getting together. So I'm incredibly pleased to be a part of the Bizarro movement. It's one of the greatest things to happen to me and means the world to me. At present, I think it's in a bit of a transitional stage, and that in the next couple of years, you'll start seeing some surprising new directions, though I can't exactly say what that'll be. But what we were talking about with the types of Bizarro, just a bit ago, from writers like James and Jeremy, I think you'll be seeing more of that and more of the writers aiming for that sort of thing. You know, if I could say, if I had to choose anything I disliked about Bizarro, it would only be that some of the recent crops of new authors coming up are not exactly engaging with a wider readership or wider, even, you know, within a wider writing community, that they're, instead of looking outward, they're looking inward. And that's good because it cultivates good relationships within Bizarro. But at the same time, you've got to look outward as well to get Bizarro out there. So I'd like to encourage a lot of those new folks to be doing that and to aim higher. You know, just a couple of years ago, I guess, I couldn't have really conceived of Lazy Fascist at all, let alone where my own writing would take me. And Patrick Lensink, you know, with everything that happened with Broken Piano for President, I always knew that Patrick was going to do well because he was talented and driven, but we had no clue about, you know, where we could take a book. And at this point, Patrick and I and a lot of others, you know, we're aiming higher, and we want to be in New York Times. We want to be covered everywhere, and we want to make ourselves be known everywhere. And it doesn't mean it'll happen, but I think it's wrong for writers to limit where they want to go. And it's good to set goals and good to try to hold yourself to accomplishing them.
And I know that's one thing about the Bizarro community that I and several of the people I've talked to have really noticed, is the community there, that you work really hard to promote each other. There's a lot of interaction with your readers and your fans, and I think that's really exciting to see a publishing group take notice of your fans and really show appreciation for the people reading your books.
I mean, none of us would be, I mean, we'd still be doing this without them, but we certainly wouldn't be making a living at it. So it's all about the fans. And I think Bizarro was created more for the fans as opposed to the writers. It wasn't like a bunch of people getting together to say, well, we're doing something different, and so let's establish that. It's more like people want something different, so let's give it to them and make it easy for them to find it.
And it's really obvious to us because we have authors from a lot of different genres on the show, and whenever we have Bizarro authors on the show, the response is overwhelming. It surpasses even some of the bigger names that we've had on the show. Not that we've had a lot of huge stars on the show. We've had one or two people that we thought, yeah, this show is going to blow up. And they do well. But when we get the Bizarro authors on, the Bizarro community and the Bizarro fans share the shit out of those links and really...
And we love them.
They love it. Yeah, we love them.
It's awesome.
And I cannot say that enough. But yeah. So, I mean, there have been times that, like, in a 24-hour period, we've just seen an episode just explode because
somebody realized that one of the people in the Bizarro community had been on the show, and all of a sudden, everybody—it feels like everybody in the world is listening to that episode. So,
oh, it's great to hear. Happy that worked out for you guys.
Yeah.
You mentioned Patrick Wensink, and something I noticed with one of Scott McClanahan's books, The Collected Works of Scott McClanahan, Volume 1, to be more specific, the cover art looks very close to a Penguin publishing book. Are you guys hoping that maybe his book will take off in the same way that Broken Piano for President did?
Oh God, no. I don't want to deal with Penguin in any sort of way like that. I love Penguin, and we weren't intending to mock them. I guess we were. no, it's a highly attractive cover, and I think it's funny. Instead of Penguin Classics, Fascist Classics, you know, he's got a patch over his eye in the picture, and I hope that there are no issues with that. To the best of my knowledge, I looked into it. That design is not protected, so I don't think there's any issue with it. I've seen it done before, and other presses haven't had a problem doing a similar thing, so I hope we can keep that cover forever.
Oh.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to ask, because we were just talking about how the writers in the community support each other, and you mentioned that you were just at a book launch at Powell's Bookstore right before you came on to record. Can we ask who that was and what book it was?
Yeah, so it was the book launch for Agro Rag Freestyle Mag, which is the collected zines that Mike Daly put together from 1984 to 1989. Mike was from York, Pennsylvania, and he was part of a freestyle biking group that was basically one of the first biking gangs to exist within the country. I hadn't quite recognized the scope and influence that he had on, he and his friends had on BMX freestyle culture until I kind of helped him organize the zines in an InDesign file when he was working on it. And just interviews with everyone, I mean, flipping through this right now, like there's a picture of Spike Jones as a kid in one of these.
Wow.
They were doing, and just like all this sort of crazy stuff like that. Like the blurb on the back from Dave Mira, who's, you know, name I knew when I was a kid, BMX riding, is just one of the biggest bikers. And he's basically saying, you know, that these guys were the first. So he also has a Lazy Patches novel coming out next year called Moon Babes of Bicycle City, which is basically like Rad meets Breaking Bad. Got a town in New Mexico called Bicycle City, and it's a lyrical novel about a family in a town of bike gangs. So yeah,
very
really, really happy and feel fortunate to be working with Mike.
I don't want to interrupt the flow here, but this is bothering me. I have to ask, what is an abortion arcade? Because it really puts an image in my head, and I can't wrap my head around it.
I read a review on Goodreads today that dissected that title for like five paragraphs. So maybe we should clear that up if we can.
All right. Do you know the heavy metal musician Thor?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Vaguely,
so
yeah.
I was in a period where I really got into Thor, and I pitched this book to Eraserhead called Abortion Arcade, in which Thor is traveling to a rundown nickel arcade to perform a show because, you know, his career's definitely gone downhill. and while at the show, lightning literally strikes an abortion clinic nearby and brings all of these fetuses back from the dead. And you've got this onslaught of zombie fetuses then attacking the arcade while Thor and a couple of his fans and the arcade attendants are trapped inside trying to find a way out and survive. And I probably wrote 15, 20,000 words of that book or something and realized it was really fucking stupid. I had these whole other... I just I had these other sections in there about a character named Banana Man who was just a dude who went around wearing a banana costume. And, so I scrapped that whole book for the most part, except for a couple sections about these metalheads, which ended up in another book, and decided to do Abortion Arcade. I turned it in as a novella collection with, you know, three novellas, and none of them have anything to do with an abortion arcade. But I'm happy to read those reviews where people really dissect the meaning of it and everything. So
because this guy is really digging deep for some existential meaning, and I hope that he listens to the show, because if I remember correctly, the one I was reading was somebody who had never read Bizarro before and decided that they were going to pick it up and see what it was all about, and they really loved it. But then, like, the title, what is that, that title? And he just dug really deep. The very existential, like, etymology of the words, and what if by abortion he means that we're aborting ourselves. And I don't know. But I really hope that that guy listens to this show, because that's awesome.
I hope he does.
Yeah, I
want him to keep his dream there.
I guess I get all of that. I mean, I think there are a lot of dead kids in all three novellas, and, you know, the characters either destroy the thing that they covet or in some other way, usually through their own backwards means, don't achieve it. So, you know, I guess it works.
It did.
Either way.
His postulations on what you could mean by arcade were a little bit further fetched, in my opinion.
All right.
I was wondering about Ask Goblins of Auschwitz, too, which those are both really awesome titles. Did you come up with that title and write the story from that, or did it just kind of develop organically?
So before the first BizarroCon, I was signed up to be in the high concept workshop with Carlton Mellick, and basically everyone in the workshop had to come up with a title, a tagline, and a synopsis for a proposed book. And then in the workshop, everyone else critiqued the pitch, so whether they buy based on the title, the concept, everything else. And Ask Goblins did pretty well there. Like, a couple weeks after BizarroCon, Carlton called me up and asked if I wanted Ask Goblins to be my next book. Which I said yes. I was really pleased that everybody wanted to think for me. But the original concept had something to do with a road trip to Big Sur. It made no sense. So I spent a couple months just coming up with new ideas for it, and eventually had this surreal version of Auschwitz, which hopefully was less in line with some of the Nazi exploitation that exists. You know, I did watch some of that in preparation for writing the book, but came away feeling somewhat offended by things like Ilse Schewolf, not because of any extreme or pornographic content, but because they downplayed the severity of the camp where you have prisoners in the films, and then softcore porn happening once in a while and occasional scenes of violence. So I wanted to pay as much respect as I could while writing something that was absolutely surreal and disorienting. And I've gotten sorts of responses from that. I've had fan letters from people in Germany who love the book, but none of their friends understand it, and have people hate it and tell me so. And then I've had people love it. So it's all across the board. But I don't regret writing it, and I'm really happy it's out in the world. And, you know, hopefully, you know, people do consider Auschwitz beyond what you thought about it in the classroom after reading it. But I don't know.
I just think that that's a massive undertaking. I mean, I guess you had to kind of know going into it there were going to be people who were like, I don't get it. I don't want to get it. It's horrible. I mean, it's just the title brings a lot of different things to mind. So to go forward with it and decide to put it out in the world anyway, I mean, it's pretty – I mean, you got balls, right?
You know, I think to put anything out there as a writer is – you have to. You're going to have a much harder time of dealing with being a writer if you can't handle those negative reviews and those people who write you off without actually attempting to engage in your work. So I guess that was a good early test for me.
That's good.
Is there like a super secret trade, a trade secret among Bizarro writers that maybe like you guys are just on acid when you write your books or something? Because I just I don't know.
I
just more creative.
I wish I could say so, but it's you know, yeah. I drink beer. I don't partake in any of the drugs anymore, and I write sober most of the time. So
good man.
Well, I think it's just a matter of sitting down in a chair and constantly coming up with new ideas. It goes back to Bradbury. Ray Bradbury used to just write out lists and lists of words, and he would rearrange them in various combinations. And anything that grabbed his attention or inspired something, he'd just start writing a story with that title to figure out where it went. And that's how a lot of his greatest stories came about. You know, Carlton Mellick does the same thing. I often do the same thing. So if there's any secret, it's that, I guess. And then that and just constantly reading.
So this is when I feel like we are obligated to get on the show. I don't know if you are aware of this, but we are putting out a ebook this summer to some of our former guests sharing their most interesting drunk stories. And one of the
I know where this is going.
You do?
I know you do because yeah. he read the thread. He cheated.
He should have kicked me out of the group.
Your question thread. So Jeremy Robert Johnson tells us that if we want a good drunk story, to ask you about the time you almost got arrested for being beaten with a 30-pound salmon while wearing a dress bar and muumuu.
Yeah, I had a good bachelor party. So Jeremy, Carlton, and Jeff Burke, they picked me up late in the evening, I think from the Eraserhead offices, and I was to undergo three trials of manhood, but each trial was revealed after I accomplished the one before it. So first trial, I was dressed in it was a sequined dress from some sort of thrift store, and that, a wig, and glasses, and given a purple plastic recorder, and made to busk downtown until I raised money. And, at first I was lucky enough, though, to head over to Voodoo Donut, where there's always a line and always tourists, so pretty quickly some woman felt bad for me and gave me $2. But I still got a lot of dirty looks, too. After that, I think we may have gone to Ground Control, the barcade in town, or we ended up, I know, at Sassy's, one of the strip clubs in town. And I think it was after Sassy's that they took me into a back alley. That was it, because it was the alley behind the strip club. And they took me back there and lined me up against the wall beside a dumpster. And each of them got to hit me with this 30-pound salmon. So I think Jeff hit me first, maybe, and then Jeremy. And then when Carlton hit me with the salmon, it just completely burst into pieces everywhere. Carlton's like, you know, he's a big, strong guy. So
I had salmon for dinner, so this is really doing a number on me.
Oh, and there was salmon everywhere. So as we were walking back to the car, we found ourselves surrounded by police cars with flashing lights. And, you know, they got out, they surrounded us, and some had you know, the gloves on, the rubber gloves, as if they're going to be doing some sort of cavity search. And I start wondering if maybe they've gotten the police involved, but they don't really seem like the type to want to involve police in anything, let alone a bachelor party, but you don't know with them. And in fact, what it was is that someone called 911 because they witnessed three men beating a transient with a fish in an alley. Now, luckily, the fish had broken into so many pieces that if you went over there, you'd have a hard time finding them. Jeremy was quickly able to talk us out of the situation, and we were let to go free. It was a pretty exciting thing to get arrested for, I guess. And then there was
That's my favorite thing that's ever happened on this show.
If I'm going to do anything like that, I'll make sure Jeremy Robert Johnson is with me to talk the cops down, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
3 minutes I've learned with a fish.
Yeah.
Oh,
that
was,
Okay. Part of my bachelor party. And then, just to let you know, I'm switching beers now.
Uh-oh, what do we got now?
I've now got Gigantic Brewing's Time Traveler beer, which I'll read the description on the side. Usually they're very cryptic about what the beers actually are, and I've never had it before. So it was upon my emergence from my craft that I realized I had traveled not to another place, but to another time. About me lumbered a number of stout men, burdened by heavy loads, finding a sudden need to slake my thirst and steady my mind. I called out to one of these porters. He pointed to a tavern, inside of which I found this roasty, chocolatey, and supremely drinkable brew.
Good Jesus.
And this is number 7 of a limited edition series that they're doing. All of their beers, except for their flagship IPA, are limited, and I've been trying to collect them all. So this is my first time trying the Time Traveler.
And this sounds like a lot like what I'm drinking. I'm thinking that because they mention a porter, that the beer is a porter.
What are you're drinking Black Butte, did you say?
I am, yeah. That's a nice chocolatey porter.
I'd say this is closer to Black Butte than any other porters that I've had. So, yeah, you would definitely think it would be like Black Butte.
I can really dig into those beer descriptions. I'm getting better at it.
I wish I had a theory on why writers always drink dark beers. Like, I don't think I've met a writer that doesn't drink dark
beers. No, I drink light beer, too. I had a Hoegaarden with dinner.
Gross.
I like a lot of lighter beers. I've been getting more into Saisons. Darker beers I tend to drink in the winter, but then I found myself still picking up some darker ones, I guess. Like this Gigantic, I didn't actually know what it was. It was just a new Gigantic, so I had to try it. But they released their darker beers now, although all the other Portland breweries were doing that in the fall and as winter seasonal. But it's still good, though. So, and I like that it's lighter and more along the lines of Black Butte because it's still highly drinkable.
Yeah, we were discussing this on Twitter. When I discovered Black Butte, it was a couple weekends ago, and I was desperately trying to get a summer beer because it's already hot here. Mm. And I was in the car. We were on our way to a barbecue. I was in the car, and my kid was asleep in the back seat. So my husband was trying to describe the beers on the shelf to me so I could pick one, which you shouldn't do that. If you know me, you shouldn't do that. But so I tell him, no IPA, no IPA, no IPA. And for some reason, the store he was in, that's like all they had. And then he started describing the Black Butte, and I was like, well, that's not a summer beer, but it sounds like it could be good. And then to my pleasant surprise, it was very easy to drink, even though it was pretty hot outside. And that's always good.
Yeah, I think Black Butte has become one of the more popular craft brews in the country, and I think it's largely because people are not opposed to dark beers, but you know most dark beers are pretty heavy, and that's going to limit your audience. But in the case of Black Butte, it's just incredibly smooth and much lighter than most people expect for a porter. So it's quite good.
There you have it. Two thumbs up.
So looking at your blog, at the part that explains what is Bizarro, I noticed one of the things was Frank Kafka meets John Waters. And I was wondering, I don't know, are there any movies out there that are that awesome and weird? Like, I imagine maybe like Holy Mountain would probably be in that degree.
But yeah, there's also something along those lines. You know, even closer
to Dr. Seuss meets David Cronenberg, which was my favorite.
Yeah, because I'd love to see a movie like that. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've seen Holy Mountain. Have you seen Sondheim?
I have.
What?
It was basically Hodorowski's take on Psycho, in a way. And I'd say it holds up pretty well to the Kafka meets John Waters pairing. So, and it's the first movie of Jodorowsky's that I saw, and still maybe my favorite, just because it's got a stronger narrative than Holy Mountain or El Topo.
I haven't actually finished Holy Mountain yet, but it's kind of it's a bit odd. It's harder to watch than a Von Trier movie. That's saying something. There.
It's interesting just to say that you haven't finished a movie. Like, with a book,
yeah.
Like, I had to put it down. I got caught up with other things. But with a movie, you're like, I haven't finished it yet. Like, you're going to go back to it someday.
It's understandable with Holy Mountain. There's a lot to chew on there. So it's pretty densely packed, symbolism and just intense scene after intense scene. So I can understand that you might turn it off and want to think about it for a while and process things before getting back to it.
It's too much to take in at once.
So we are getting short on time. Like,
yeah, I wanted to touch real quick on another listener question we had from J. Slayton Jocelyn, and he asked, what makes a book out of Lazy Fascist different from Eraserhead Press, i.e. what kind of subcategory does it publish?
You know, we're all over the map in terms of subcategories, and I think one thing that defines Lazy Fascist is that we don't really concern ourselves too much with categories. When it's time to list a book on Amazon, I usually go for humorous categories, like Rontel by Sam Pink is in Cat Care. you know, a lot of things like that. But, you know, we've published horror, we've published minimalist, realist stuff, historical fiction. It's not really about categories so much as whether or not it's going to pair well with the rest of the books coming out that quarter, with the books that year, and with the wider catalog. So basically, I've got a map, and I'm trying to fill in various pieces. And when I find a book that I feel fills a need, then I try to acquire it.
Oh.
And then a good follow-up question to that, I guess, is another one from Sean Leonard, because like I said, he wrote the show. When we say
he's been very excited about this one.
Yeah, he says he'd love to hear more about the just-announced 2014 Lazy Fascist release, Egg Salad in the Bathtub. He says the title makes him imagine the smell and then makes him want to throw up.
I'm so excited about Egg Salad in the Bathtub. And it's quite funny. I read Sean's comment, and I just got a text from Chloe Caldwell, the author, this morning that she threw up last night. She went out for her birthday, and then I read Sean's comment. I was going to tell her that now her title makes people want to throw up so they can be like friends. But,
it made me decide against egg salad for lunch. So
egg salad's the best, though. Like, nothing can turn me off of egg salad. But, yeah, Egg Salad in the Bathtub is basically about a woman who perceives herself as straight, moving to a new city and falling in love with a woman. I guess it's a love story peppered with heroin, MDMA, acne, yoga, family, and lots of egg salad.
Wow. That's kind of a full gamut of things to cover in a book.
Yeah. I'm really excited for that one. So that'll be out Valentine's Day next year.
Oh, cool. Now everybody knows what to get their loved ones for Valentine's Day.
Egg salad.
Don't even advance notice. Egg
and if
salad.
They ask for it, know that it's a book and not a fun Valentine's Day fetish.
Yeah, like a heart-shaped Valentine's Day sandwich.
Yes.
Egg salad in it.
Romantic.
Sat in the bathtub. This is your gift. And they're like, what? And you're like, well, I had to order it today. It's not here yet. So I'm going to give a little bit of attention to Lazy Fascist for us. Like I said, in right before we started the show, I know a lot of people are really in love with this press. One thing, there was an article that Patrick Winsing had written, and it went around on the web, and I shared it on my page, and a friend made the comment that Lazy Fascist is the best name for a press ever. So, and I agree. I want to know where that came from.
Originally, it was the title of a short story in my collection, Lost in Cat Brainland, but it's definitely taken on a life of its own. And I guess it really gets to the heart of the sort of the absurd sensibility that we're aiming for, not just in books, but in life. And, you know, books are also a small part of life, and the act of books is, while mentally and emotionally engaging, a bit lazy in terms of, you know, you're mostly sitting unless you read on a treadmill. So I guess this is the best answer I can give you right now. People always ask me this, and I always get caught off guard.
We're definitely not
fascist, though. That comes up a lot more seriously, where people want to know if we're really fascist, and if the person behind Lazy Fascist is a fascist. And it's hard, because I wrote a book called Ask Goblins of Auschwitz, so sometimes I can't defend myself as well as I should be able to. And now that this has come up multiple times in the past couple of weeks, I think I'm definitely going to work on you know, my proper, like, message of response.
Good
to
know.
Well, are you lazy? Because it doesn't come across like you're lazy. You've got a lot of stuff happening all the time. So maybe you could say, why would you assume that I was a fascist if you can see that I'm not lazy?
Well, you know, I think that's kind of it, too, though. You know, you have to work your ass off with books. Like, it's hard work. But it's hard work that isn't physical work, you know? So I respect people who do physical labor, and I respect people who, you know, have to wake up at a certain time every day and go do something that they don't like. So, you know, in a sense, I guess, being a writer or an editor, you are a lazy fascist, that you're tearing yourself apart and sometimes tearing other people apart because of the stress and anxiety you're going through over this make-believe thing that you're doing, but you're not really doing anything, but you're doing a make-believe thing that does impact people in really deep ways and can save lives, or at least, you know, provide some sort of escape for a couple hours. So, you know.
I think you have your answer now for the future. That was really great.
I usually get around to it. I have to just tell a few stupid, funny anecdotes first.
So
I wanted to ask a listener question from Patrick Wensink. He said, how much fish can you eat in one sitting?
Well, I got a couple catfish fillets in the fridge, and I'm wearing a T-shirt from Spud's, a fish and chips cafe in Seattle, so I can eat a shit ton of fish in a single sitting.
Rob Hart wanted us to make you prove that on the air, but you did say that the catfish was frozen, so I guess we'll have to pass on that.
You know, I've been to an all-you-can-eat fish and chips place before. On my honeymoon, my wife and I went to a place called Moby Dick's, and we got the all-you-can-eat fish and chips. And I did eat a lot of fish then, but I didn't eat enough to get kicked out. So I'm not a total glutton, I guess, which is kind of shameful.
Now you have something to aspire to.
Yeah, getting kicked out of a Red Lobster or something for eating too much all-you-can-eat fish.
There you go. So we got a couple things that we want to plug. I think we want to plug Caleb J. Ross's thing again, because it is a weekly thing. Cameron, in case you're not aware, Caleb J. Ross is running a fundraiser for the March of Dimes. And the background on this is that until a few weeks ago, he had never read any Harry Potter and did not wish to. But he realized that people who love Harry Potter a lot. And hopefully they also love babies. So the deal he's made is that for every $10 he gets donated, he will read 2 pages of Harry Potter. And even if he likes the book, this is the important part, even if he loves it, when the money stops coming in for his March of Dimes fundraiser, he's going to stop reading. So now... No,
I'll
making sacrifices for babies, Cameron. This is a big deal.
Well, it's a good cause, but he'll get hooked and he'll go on. But I'll be sure to donate. Where's the link to donate?
We're going to link that up on our episode notes, complete with the video. And also, if you look at our last episode with Craig Walwork, that it's already linked up. The video is there. All you have to do is donate what you can, and at the end of every week, he tallies up the donations that have been received, he reads that number of pages, and then he updates his video blog on YouTube with his impressions of what he's read.
That's awesome.
So if you love Harry Potter or you love babies, which I also have never read Harry Potter, so I don't know, like, how strong that love goes, but it appears to me it's deep. And I love babies. I don't want them to be sick, right? So
I like the cause. I like the cause, but I'll say that that is two overrated things, and that's babies and Harry Potter. I don't know.
You tried this last week, and you got shot down. Nobody is going to support you saying that you shouldn't give money to help sick babies.
No.
It's not going to happen, Dakota.
And it is a cause that's near and dear to Caleb's heart. So
I
appreciate
it. Although I
still
wanted it to be. I thought you were saying you were raising money for the March of Eyes for sick babies. Babies live in a marsh, which I could also get behind, but I'll donate anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
pretty mature babies.
And then I'm going to do something that I don't normally do, but I would do it more often if I felt like our listeners would tolerate it, but maybe they won't. last year, I had the beautiful moment in my life where I received my first acceptance letter for a piece of fiction. And I received it from a Literati magazine. Great fucking magazine, by the way. And I'm not just saying that because they accepted me. I read some of their issues before they accepted me. I continue to read what's coming out. They are up for what is known as the Saboteur Award, and we're going to link that up. And it's very easy to vote. There's lots of really cool categories. If you're not familiar with all of the categories, you don't have to vote on all the categories. It takes like 35 seconds. I just did it. If you feel so inclined, check out a Literati, and I'll link them up, and then go and cast a vote, because it's always cool to see presses that are willing to put out really cool shit. They put out great art, they put out great fiction, and there's no pretense about it. It doesn't matter if you are someone like me who had nothing published and no weight to your name at all, or if you're somebody really awesome and you feel like giving them a story, they'll put it out so long as it's good, and there's lots of good stuff, and it covers a lot of different types of fiction, a lot of different types of art. It's really cool, so I want to make sure everybody understands that something near and dear to my heart, something near and dear to Caleb's heart, babies are definitely more important, but this is something that the voting for Literati, it doesn't take any of your money, so you can do both.
Cool.
I can afford both of those.
There you go. You do both. And a Literati is also free to read. So there you go. There's all kinds of freeness wrapped in that. So take your money and give it to Caleb, and then take your free time and give it to a Literati. And us.
Yeah, give me your money.
No. Give your money to Caleb.
I have nothing to offer. Yeah.
I know.
So,
like we are afraid
like,
my okay. Beer.
We're kind of done on time. Cameron, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to stick in there, any current releases from Lazy Bastards or anything you've got that's coming out that we've overlooked. This is you've got the floor.
Yeah, I'd say this summer look for In Heaven, Everything is Fine, fiction inspired by David Lynch, which is an anthology I'm editing. It'll be published by Eraserhead. It features stories and poems by David Jay of Bauhaus. I don't know if any of you are Bauhaus fans. Nick Vomitas, Thomas Sagati, Jeremy Robert Johnson, Blake Butler, and about 30 other writers. So that'll be out this summer from Eraserhead.
Nice.
Very exciting.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us and being a good sport, even though you came in on us talking about bat cunningless.
Oh, thanks. I wish we'd talk more about fruit bat sexual rituals. That might have to be a topic for a part two.
Well, I'll go ahead and link that article up in the episode notes so everybody can be in on that joke.
That's really what happens in our pre-show meetings. No,
that really happened.
We discussed
Cameron popped in
animal
we
sex habits.
Fruit bats having oral sex.
I'll send you an article about crayfish mating rituals, and maybe next week or whenever you're doing another episode, you can talk about that until the guest comes in and make them feel like I did.
There you go.
We do love you.
But really, thanks for doing the show, and I will have...
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And as usual, we'll link all of the wonderful things we discussed. And, yeah, give your money to babies. Make Caleb read Harry Potter.
Marsh babies.
Marsh babies.